This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's John Dalby Banks Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see johncast.net.
Joining me now is Professor David Kirkby from UC Irvine and CEA Sackley. Hello.
Good morning.
And yesterday you gave a talk on how to measure the universe with cosmic sound. To start with, can you tell me a little bit about what you're actually trying to measure about the universe?
So we're really trying to measure how it's expanded in the past. So we're trying to track the history of the expansion of the universe. And the reason we're interested in that is because it tells us what the forces were that were shaping that expansion. So in particular, things like dark matter and dark energy.
So you're looking like at the expansion from very early times, or are you looking at in any specific time period?
So with any sample, there's some redshift associated with that sample, and that's going to determine how far back in time you're looking at the expansion.
So by redshift, you mean sort of shifting of light towards the red end of the spectrum?
Right. So shifting of the light because of the expansion of the universe. So like a Doppler shift that you'd hear with a siren, but this time because of the universe actually expanding and stretching out the wavelengths of the light. So.
Okay, cool. You said you're going to do this through cosmic sound. What exactly is cosmic sound?
Well, so it's a little complicated. It took me a while to understand it. But the way I think about it is that right after the Big Bang, there were some sound waves that were created, but they only lasted for a short amount of time. So it's as if the Big Bang, you know, had a noise associated with it. But at some point, so those sound waves traveled out, and at some point, the sound couldn't travel anymore. It just stopped. And so those sound waves got frozen in, and that basically lasted, throughout the rest of the expansion of the universe. So it's really those frozen echoes of these initial sound waves. They're not really sound waves you can hear. This is more of a scientist's, definition of sound as a wave of pressure moving through a fluid. So,
why did they get frozen? Was there a change in the universe?
So yeah, that's a good question. So in the early universe, there was the fluid the gas that the sound was moving through was a mixture of light and ordinary matter. So matter made of atoms. So that's not really a state of matter that we see today, because it only occurs when you have very, very high energies, because you have a very dense material. So it's a bit like a plasma that you could create in a fluorescent bulb, right, today. And so the universe at that time, the light and the you couldn't see through the universe. So I couldn't see you across the room if we were sitting in the early universe. So light just couldn't travel in straight lines. It kept bumping into to matter, and they were really very tightly coupled together. So it's kind of an unusual. It's hard to imagine, but that allows sound waves to exist. But as universe expanded, this fluid basically broke apart, and the light started behaving the way we think light is behaving. And all of a sudden, it's as if there were clouds in the early universe, and at some point, those clouds just sort of disappeared, like the mist burning off in the morning.
Okay, brilliant. So how can you actually go about measuring these sound waves?
So if the universe had been perfectly smooth, and there had just been one little patch, one spot where there was a little extra stuff in the universe, then what we would see in the night sky is we would see basically a little, we'd see that patch, and there would be a little ring around it, a very faint ring around it. And that faint ring would be this sound wave that got frozen in. Now we don't, and the size of that ring, it would be about twice the size of the moon, okay? So it's, you know, it's something quite big, and you could easily see. And we don't see that in the night sky. And the reason for that is that the universe actually had lots and lots of little bumps and valleys in the early distribution of stuff. And so really what we see looks a lot more jumbled, but it's just because I like to think of each little bump of stuff in the early universe like a raindrop, and then so the night sky we see is really like lots of raindrops falling onto a pond. And when you have enough raindrops falling on a pond, you can't really see anymore the circular ripples from individual raindrops. It just looks like a big jumble. And that's really the way we see the universe today. So.
So it's all kind of, they're all added together, all one on top of the another, all jumbled up.
And you right.
How do you actually go about separating those? Can you do them? Do you do them with like models or?
So we use statistics, and what that means is that we try and reconstruct statistically this raindrop pattern by looking how likely it is to find galaxies that are a certain distance apart on the sky. So it's something you can't really see by eye. If I showed you a picture which had this raindrop pattern in it or didn't, you would never be able to tell by eye it's there. So you really have to just crunch through the math and look at the statistics, and you'll see that it's slightly more likely to find galaxies that are a few degrees apart than galaxies that are a little bit further apart or a little bit closer apart. There's sort of a special, a magic separation for galaxies where it's slightly more likely to find them.
Is it only galaxies that you use to find these patterns, or do you use other objects as well?
So galaxies are the classic way of seeing these sound waves. What we did is actually a little bit trickier. So instead of using galaxies, we look for the echoes of these sound waves in the space between the galaxies, which is something you ordinarily can't see at all. So it's what we call the intergalactic medium. And although you can't see it, it actually has most of the atoms in the universe. So you're probably the 90 or 95% of the atoms in the universe are in this invisible stuff between the galaxies. So we have to do some tricks in order to be able to see where things are in this intergalactic medium. So what we use is we shine a bright light through this intergalactic medium, and that helps us see the structure. So we can't actually put bright lights out in the universe, so we have to find things that are already there doing the job for us. And so we use objects called quasars, and that's so that they're extremely bright objects that you can see from very far away, and then they basically illuminate this intergalactic medium, and we can see from the shadows that it casts where the stuff is. And what we're really looking for is just hydrogen, so just, you know, the simplest atom possible.
So as the light comes from this quasar towards us, like hydrogen creates like absorption signatures.
Right. So the hydrogen. Light. Right. So as the light comes towards us, it will get absorbed if there's some hydrogen in this. So it's really like creating a shadow because of the absorption. It's like if you look at a bright light through a tissue, some of the light will get attenuated. You'll see less light because some of the light got absorbed in the tissue. So we're doing the same thing here.
It's amazing that you can sort of map, so to speak, hydrogen through the universe by looking at light from really, really far away. I just personally think that's really amazing.
And in fact, a crucial part of that is the fact that we're looking at this light over very large distances, because otherwise we wouldn't know where the hydrogen was. We would just know there was some hydrogen between us and these bright lights. But the fact that as the light travels towards us, it's changing its color continuously, means that there's only one special color where the light can be absorbed by hydrogen. So we can figure out from which color of light is missing from the light that reaches us on Earth, where exactly the hydrogen was that absorbed it. So
that's really cool. That's really cool. What sort of instruments do you use to look at these? Is there a special telescope somewhere that does these observations?
Yeah, so we use a telescope that's called the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. So it's been started running in I think 2000. The overall mission of that telescope is to make three-dimensional atlases of the things outside of our galaxy. In order to study how much the hydrogen is absorbing light from these distant quasars, you can't take photographs of the sky, because you really need to see for each wavelength of light how much absorption there's been. So you need to use a spectrograph, which just basically separates the light into its constituent wavelengths. But you don't want to take just one spectrograph a night, so the Sloan Digital Sky Survey has developed a technique of taking 1,000 spectra all at once.
It was so 1,000 simultaneously?
Yeah, simultaneously, yeah.
That's a massive number.
Yeah. So that's what enables us to actually really do a survey and measure lots of these things over just a few years. So.
How does it do that? How does it collect 1,000 spectra simultaneously?
what we do is instead of taking a photograph, we have a camera that's basically, I mean, just like a normal digital camera. But what we do is we feed into the camera the light from optical fibers, the same type of fiber they would stick into your knee to do a arthroscopic surgery. And but that what goes into that fiber at one end is the light from a galaxy or a quasar. And then at the other end, the light is put onto something like a prism, or really a diffraction grating, that just spreads the light out into its constituent colors. So really, it turns that spot of light into a long streak where you can see the individual colors. And then it's those streaks that go onto our camera. So our images actually look quite odd because you just see all these streaks of lights on them. One aspect that's interesting for this project is that all the data is public, so.
Oh, all the data is entirely public?
Yeah.
Okay, so people can go and have a look at the data.
Yeah, so every year we release a new chunk of our data, and we just, last July, we did our ninth data release, but all the data is freely available. It's actually quite easy to get started just in your web browser. So if you go to stss.org, with a few clicks, you can actually tell it what part of the sky you're interested in. It will pull up the photograph of that part of the sky. So it's as if you have in your computer, a high powered telescope that you can point to any part of the sky and pull up an image, even if it's the middle of the day. and once you've found an image, you can look for an object you're interested in. And if it has been measured spectroscopically, you could then click on that and actually see the spectrum, so the exactly how much light was absorbed from at each different wavelength. So if you'd like to look for a quasar, you want to look for faint blue smudges in the image. And then if you look at one of those spectra, you could try and figure out how we determine the redshift of those objects. So
that's brilliant that it's just there, freely available for people to look at. And yeah, I think that's brilliant. Also, in your talk, you were talking about the future plans for future surveys. Can you tell us a little bit about those?
Right. So, although we're doing these comprehensive surveys, making these 3D atlases, we haven't really reached the limit of what you can see from Earth. And so, there's a lot more we could do with an even bigger and faster survey. So, right now, we're able to measure the spectra of 1,000 objects at a time. So the next jump is going to require going to about 5,000 spectra at a time. And that's quite a challenge, because right now, someone actually comes and by hand plugs in all of the optical fibers into holes drilled into a big aluminum plate.
And they do that every night?
They do that during the day. So, okay. Yeah. And then, to have them ready for the night. But that just won't work, anymore. The fibers are just too small and too closely packed on the plate. So the next generation is going to have to use some sort of robotic positioners. So where there's actually you can steer each you can position each fiber just electronically to capture the light from some target object. So that's a big challenge, and that's a problem that people are working on now and will be necessary to go to the next generation.
Oh, well, it's all really exciting, really amazing stuff. And thank you very much for telling us all about your work.
Thank you. It's been fun.